Hi, hello everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am one of your co-hosts, Paul David.
And I'm your other co-host, Maya Doran-Pohombe.
And today we're talking about prescribing video games for anxious children with Manjul, who's the CEO and co-founder of BFB Labs. Welcome to the pod, Manjul.
Thank you so much, Paul and Maya.
So we're going to talk today about a topic that's near and dear to our heart. So tech for young people. And as we know, there's been a massive sort of crisis of mental health for young people who are engaging in social media and just, you know, coming out of the COVID pandemic, just kind of really struggling with their well-being. So by way of introduction, BFB Labs provides digital therapy for children through an app-based video game called LumiNova, which has been funded and commissioned by the NHS. LumiNova combines CBT with psychoeducation and ethical gaming to help children self-manage anxiety. It's available on demand to children in the UK via referrals at schools, social care, and local NHS organizations. Children using the app can select from a range of challenges such as fear of the dark, struggling to make friends, or falling behind in school. Many of the common challenges that young people every day face.
As well as helping young people build lifelong skills to self-manage their mental health, the game also provides real-time engagement and health outcomes data, which BFB provides the NHS with. Manjul's background is in impact-led innovation, having worked for the BBC, Shelter, Oliver Wyman, and several startups. She then moved on to entrepreneurial ventures, founding Soulscape, a well-being travel experience platform, and then iHeroes, the UK's first child-led campaign to tackle avoidable blindness. Welcome to the pod, Manjul.
Thank you.
So what gap in child and adolescents' mental health provision was BFB Labs founded to address? Has anything surprised you in the data about the impact of LumiNova and other games?
Yeah, I mean, I think before I go into statistics and I throw all the kind of like big news at you, I think I'd like to bring into the discussion the story of a young person named Josh. Josh is someone I have known for a couple of years now. When he was refusing to go to school, he would break into tears every morning. He would kind of be stuck at the back of the car seat when it was time to go to school, mainly because he was anxious about school and his family as well. Josh's mom, who happens to be a friend of mine, tried to get support, but he wasn't at high risk enough. That is, he wasn't feeling suicidal. He wasn't self-harming, and therefore did not get seen or supported by mental health services. So without timely, effective support, Josh would probably grow up with the burden of untreated childhood ill mental health, which would end up affecting his career, relationships, well-being, pretty much every aspect of his life. So the challenge here really is that of demand and supply. There's been a huge surge in demand for mental health support for young people, where services are feeling extremely squeezed, having to prioritize those who are at highest risk, which means that almost 70% of children and young people who need support today but are not at high risk enough yet will get access to no evidence-based support. At the same time, scaling conventional support mechanisms is really hard, and the pandemic is a proof of that. And by conventional support, I mean face-to-face services where you have to travel or the clinician has to find an opportune time. You have to build your rapport with them and so on and so forth. That is if you're lucky enough to get access to that level of specialist support. And then, of course, there's the huge challenge of stigma still attached to seeking mental health support. We've seen some digital alternatives crop up, which happen to be often a copy-paste of adult approaches or created by, I guess, clinical experts that may not deliver high-quality user experience, or be on the other end of the spectrum where they're created by digital agencies, which may not be as evidence-based as they need to be. So we really created LumiNova for child anxiety, not to serve as a pill that's going to fix everything, but to build skills in managing mental health. And our view always has been that we can make this happen as early as possible in a young person's life continuum, which is engaging, non-stigmatizing, and evidence-based. So LumiNova really is for those 70% of kids who are probably unlikely to get any access to evidence-based support.
And just in terms of that example of Josh and the problem of demand and supply, how does LumiNova work at particularly targeting young boys so that they don't become part of that, you know, horrendous statistic about 16 to 45-year-old men?
I love this question. And you know why? Because when you look at mental health support services, the maximum number of presentations or support sought is on part of those who identify as female. That means in mainstream support systems, there's something that is amiss where we are not able to reach young boys, or they don't present in the same way as girls would present. And of course, there are other gender identities that we are able to kind of like bring into the picture as well here. What we are seeing with LumiNova is that we almost have a 50-50 split of users who identify as female and those who identify as male, and also other gender identities that are currently using LumiNova. So there's something about, I guess, the game design, the branding, the packaging, and of course, the environment that we put users in, the user journeys that we are able to help realize. We are able to create, you know, identities within the gaming intervention, which allow any user to create a sense of resonance with the avatar. So there's a real value that we've been able to unlock by exploiting a gaming channel as a vehicle to deliver that therapeutic support. And for young boys, I mean, there is a, you know, space that they are able to enter without having to necessarily sort of reject it because it's not Fortnite enough, or it's not Minecraft enough, or whatever else, which are also the kind of games that we have always sort of steered clear of, because we are kind of like treading this fine balance of creating a digital gaming environment, which is A, ethical, B, safe, and C, delivers a therapeutic promise it makes, without losing its engagement value, which is often the risk that interventions that have attempted to gamify a user experience kind of experience. So we've been quite successful in actually doing that, and quite proud of that.
And in terms of sort of taking advantage of the gaming medium in order to develop those characters that users can really identify with, could you talk me through the sort of balance between user choice and what are just sort of the guidelines of the games, and how you came to working out how much sort of autonomy users should get? And also, perhaps as a follow-up, could you describe some of the sort of avatars and characters in LumiNova?
Sure. So maybe I'll do the latter first before I forget what the second question was. In terms of avatars, you know, like with any gaming environment, you start with a small collection, and then you start creating assets that you can pick and mix, right? So I can be a young boy with any skin tone I want, wearing whatever gear is available to me, and at the same time, I can adorn a head turban. I can be that person in the gaming environment. Maybe that relates to me. Maybe that speaks to me in some shape and form. And at the same time, I can be somebody else who's dressed up like a Luminaut, which is a little bit like an astronaut in your space costume. And, you know, you have all your sort of props and your assets attached to you. So you can be whoever you want to be. And increasingly, we realize that presenting choice was really important. But of course, everything, given that we are health tech intervention rather than just a intervention for entertainment purposes, we have to adhere to the clinical guidelines and of course safety guidelines. So there are lots of kind of like do's and don'ts. One of the things that, you know, we learned when we were engaging in extensive co-design and co-creation, which by the way is an intrinsic part of what we do, and that's how we learn and improve, right? We're constantly listening, constantly understanding, constantly testing. Parents told us the gaming is not something that they'd support because the children already do a lot of gaming. So they couldn't tell the difference between gaming for entertainment and a therapeutic intervention game, right? And we understood that, you know, a lot of parents were quite wary that the kids were spending, let's say, 3 hours, 4 hours a day at times to basically play through a specific game on their console, on their mobile phone, on the laptop, on the parents' laptop sometimes. So we included certain parameters. For example, when you engage in the gaming journey, you can really only play it for 30 to 40 minutes in a single 24-hour cycle, which means that we are able to combat a lot of those, I guess, apprehensions that families have around the ethics around gaming. So we class it as positive screen time, a little bit similar to the kind of time that you would spend, you know, improving your health and well-being online or in an application, or if you're doing a math tuition, that's all considered to be positive screen time. So that's really how we help sort of govern some of the activity within the gaming environment. And you're right. I mean, there's a really interesting balance between, you know, how much or how little choice can we present. We are working with a younger age bracket of children, so 7 to 12 year old, rather than the sort of 13 to 19, the teenage years, where young people definitely want more independence, they want more autonomy. Our intervention is child-led, so we have a finite choice of different assets and different sort of journeys that you can help realize. But the choice is big enough to keep a user engaged such that they go through the therapeutic journey, they're able to complete the essential steps. And that balance of, you know, fun and therapeutic steps, given especially the fact that we are using exposure therapy, which recreates fear scenarios, which is intimidating and scary for anyone, right? Whether you're a child, whether you're an adult, whether you're an elderly person, it's a difficult process to go through. But we are able to ease young people into that process by adding a sense of progression, which also lends itself quite nicely into the gaming environment.
Could you talk us through perhaps one example of that exposure therapy and how it sort of manifests itself on the game and then the impact that it really has on the child?
So, I mean, given this is a podcast, we can talk about the fear of speaking in public, right? Or speaking in front of a classroom or to a group. When you do that amidst family, friends, people who you're comfortable with, it seems like a walk in the park. But if somebody invites you to London Excel and tells you that you'll be addressing an audience of 300 people, it's a completely different story. And that is definitely something that would, bring the nerves in someone like myself. So the way exposure therapy works is that you identify a fear scenario, which in this instance is speaking to a large audience that I'm unfamiliar with in an unfamiliar setting. Breaking it down into small steps, which increase in their intensity to induce anxiety as you progress through them. So for example, I might break down that fear into 8 challenges. Some of the earlier challenges could include doing a voice-guided imagine activity in the application itself, which helps me recreate that scenario that I'm fearing so much, right? The important thing is to reflect before and after each of these steps, thinking about how you think you're going to feel if you were to do that step, and then reflecting back afterwards and realizing that what you thought was going to happen, i.e. you thought that you might feel sick, you thought that you're going to break into sweat, you thought that you start shaking on stage, none of those things happen as a result of doing that actual activity or the simulation of that activity. Then you could progress on to looking at photos and videos, which are all simulations that we enable within the application environment. We also then progress users on to actually doing real world challenges. So then we would, in this instance, we would encourage a user to go and maybe see the venue, you know, just go and experience what that stage looks like, maybe listen to someone else doing the talk, maybe look at, someone else kind of doing the talk from behind stage, and of course then build your courage, your sort of confidence up to actually maybe doing a bit of a dress rehearsal the day before or speaking to the organizers and getting a really good sense of how what the flow of the presentation would be like on the given day. So this is a very gradual, progressive experience which eventually takes you up to that point where you're able to face the very fear scenario that's been holding you back from engaging in an activity. In the context of children and young people, you know, this is very much applicable to the things that you become anxious about doing, which relate to your everyday life. It could be, you know, going to your friend's birthday party. It could be doing a sleepover or sleeping alone at home at night. So hopefully that gives you a good sense of how exposure therapy actually broken down within the gaming environment.
I'd love to dig a bit more into the gaming environments you've built and talk about the first game you built at BFB Labs, which was Champion of Shanghai, hope I'm saying that right, which helps users practice diaphragmatic breathing. It's the first time I ever used that word as well. How did this game shape Luminova and what lessons did you learn from its deployment?
So I just call it Champions for short, in short. So champions understanding is designed to train users in emotional regulation. And diaphragmatic breathing, also known as deep belly breathing, is a really powerful way of doing it because it can trigger your parasympathetic nervous system within seconds, enabling your body to go into a rest and digest mode rather than fight or flight, right? So you're in a moment of stress, your body's telling you, I want to run away or I want to fight, and you're feeling this rush of emotions. What diaphragmatic breathing, deep belly breathing enables you to do if you practice it there and then is that it enables you to basically stay calm, stay focused, and be in control of your emotions. So very, very powerful in that sense. And it's also using biofeedback technology, which helps us gather heart rate variability data and feed it into the gaming environment in real time. And when you see a user's experience of acknowledging how they are able to control the game with their mind and their body, it's phenomenal. It is so satisfying to have invested years of your life building something as compelling as this. So when we actually created Champions of Dushenga, one of the things we thought about was that this technique is so powerful. It's so engaging. It's unlike yoga classes or deep meditation classes, which, often teenagers find a little bit boring. They feel like it doesn't really speak to them. They don't find it interesting enough. But Champions of Dushenga was able to overcome that challenge. We thought that we'll put it out into the real world, and every child, and we're talking about maybe a billion kids, every child in the world will get access to it. They'll be able to benefit from it. They'll be able to use it for a nominal fee. When we put it out into the real world, we found that it was only really your middle-class families who were buying Champions of Dushenga. They had the resources, they had the awareness, they had the knowledge, and they had the recognition that this is something that can really help their young person. That completely and totally shattered our vision of enabling democratic access. We were looking at the world with rose-tinted glasses and realizing that it's just not how things work. So this helped us devise a very different strategy in the case of Numinoa for child anxiety, in that we were able to provide it to health and social care organizations, as you mentioned earlier, Maya and Paul, who are then able to provide it at no cost at the point of use to families in their local area, reaching those marginalized groups who are probably unlikely to get access otherwise. So Champions of Dushenga, interestingly, played this very, very unexpected role in the way we were trying to enable access in a way that is democratic and equitable.
And I was wondering, in terms of the surprises that came with the deployment of Champions, video games are known to sort of cultivate quite organic online communities. Have you had plans about sort of integrating community building mechanisms into your relationships with your users?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because we are a health tech provider that provides interventions to a organization which is either providing health or social care support or education support, which then provides it to a family, to a young person. So we're kind of like connected very indirectly. And one thing to mention is that the healthcare space is quite risk averse, and for the right reasons, right? They're protective of their audiences. So one of the things that we haven't been able to exploit as much is this community building aspect. There's a lot of kind of like regulations and compliance that we have to adhere to. We are a class one low risk registered medical device with the UK's MHRA, which basically means that we have a very kind of like strict protocol to follow, which is known as a post-market follow-up plan, and we have to adhere to it. We have to adhere to clinical safety risk guidelines, data protection guidelines, and so on and so forth, which functions very differently if you are the creator of Roblox. Like Roblox can go out there and do whatever they want because they are providing a fun game. We are not a fun game provider. We are a health intervention game provider within the gaming environment. So the boundaries of, our sort of playground, the area, the premise within which we are able to operate and ensure safety, especially for children and young people, building communities in the same way as you see in traditional mainstream games is actually quite challenging and is something that we haven't done yet.
Well, in terms of your relationships with these bodies in the NHS, you've been recommended by the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence as a first-line treatment option to treat anxiety in children and young people. How long had this been the goal for Luminova? And what is next for the game?
It's really interesting because I guess the National Institute of Health and Care Excellence, also known as NICE, getting a recommendation from them is like getting endorsement from the Pope. You know, you can only really achieve it if you can prove scientific rigor and you can deliver efficacy data that of high impact. It's a goal for any health solution maker. Can I just say that? Irrespective of whether you are providing a whole new way of supporting people with diabetes or cancer or mental health, getting a sort of NICE recommendation is kind of like a really big milestone because it's an extremely rigorous process. We started building evidence 2 years before launching our solution in 2020. So in total, it took us about 5 years, multiple trials, extensive co-design, co-creation with stakeholders, families, NHS experts, children, academic experts, and of course, developing a large repository of data to get to a point where NICE thought that these guys are doing something, you know, that is effective and at the same time safe and clinically sound. I guess looking ahead, we will continue to build our evidence in line with NICE's guidance. They have an evidence standards framework, so anyone who's listening to this podcast can probably look it up. It is very well established, very well regarded, and gives you something to anchor your efforts to, right? When you're building your evidence strategy, that's what you can anchor your efforts to. We are also building more solutions for other mental health disorders, not only for 7 to 12 year olds, but actually extending the age bracket to 13 to 25. So watch this space. And yeah, I mean, of course, to realize our reach and to further the opportunity for BFP labs and for young people to get access to these proven interventions, which are also fun at the same time, we are looking for active partnerships in health, social care and private healthcare space.
Brilliant. And in terms of that co-designing process that is so integral to your product, could you talk us through what that looks like?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, co-design is a small component of what we do in the application of human-centered design. So human-centered design as an approach places the very people you are creating a solution for at the center, at the heart of all your activities. With regards to co-design specifically involving young people in what we are doing, right from when you have an early sort of problem statement, is that the right problem we are solving? Are we completely missing the mark and solving a problem that you don't really care about or isn't really your problem, but I think is your problem as an adult? So I think problem validation. And then, of course, there's a lot of sort of learning that innovators can receive from young people when you co-create, build narratives together, build concepts together. And one of the things that we learned very, very early on is that we can't think of young people as young people. We have to think of them as less experienced people, because that helps kind of like really bring their voice on the table in a way that is equitable. Otherwise, you don't want to do the whole Comic Sans font and graffiti vibes. It just doesn't land. Young people have high expectations. We've been in numerous scenarios where we've gone in with, let's say, a concept that we've prototyped as a board game, presented it to a group of young people, and they've completely ripped it apart. And they basically said that, look, I don't think this is going to work. And this is how you can make it work. But that's gold, right? That is crucial information that can help us sort of steer our efforts into the right direction such that we are able to meet children and young people where they are at, rather than trying to impose something on them that is an adult's view of what a solution should look like. This is a mistake a lot of innovators make, i.e. copy-pasting an adult model into the children's space without actually necessarily going through that co-creation, that user testing, that sort of feedback, that co-development exercise. We really champion that, and it's not just in terms of, I guess, the products we build, but every function within our organization, be it implementation, sales, HR, finance, everybody has training in human-centered design. So we encourage everyone to kind of apply those principles to their own practice. If I have a problem around implementation, I can bring, you know, stakeholders, NHS clinicians, practitioners into the room, learn from them by allowing myself to be vulnerable and presenting my ideas so that they can rip them apart, of course.
That's great. So I want to talk about one of your previous ventures, just to pull back a little bit. iHeroes, I love the graphics that you have for them. It's really, really creative and artistic. You delivered interactive workshops to train children to learn and pass on knowledge about eye healthcare through iHeroes. So I wanted to just get a sense of what's drawn you to designing health initiatives for kids, for young people.
Yeah, I mean, iHeroes is a passion project, which I founded with a good friend of mine who was working as an ophthalmologist at Moorfields at the time. Met a 9-year-old girl who was suffering from avoidable sight loss, so blindness that can be avoided, and ended up being visually impaired because her problem wasn't caught early enough. So iHeroes was based on a model that empowered children, positioned them as agents of change, and helped overcome barriers in their respective communities around language, mobility, stigma, to essentially raise awareness around eye health amidst adults. So go for eye checks regularly. There are lots of myths around it, busting a lot of those myths. And this is the training that we delivered in school environments. As a result of the workshops, so each workshop was 60 minutes long, 1 hour. Every child that attended that workshop was likely to inform up to 8 adults in their respective communities. How powerful is that? So if you're informing, I guess, 100 young people, you are able to reach 800 adults, potentially. I think in our society in general, especially here in the West, we have a very fixed view of children, right? We think the children are children. We need to think about what they need, be the providers, you know, give them what they need, put it on the table. I guess with iHeroes and also our current work around youth mental health at BFD Labs, we've always been like heavily focused on skill building. That changes a young person's role, right? You are learning, you're building skills rather than constantly being a passive recipient of information, of help, of all your basic set of needs. So we don't believe in kind of like fixing challenges for them, but giving them the right skills and support so that they can learn and build their knowledge, their resilience. So I think it's kind of always been around placing kids as agents of change, either for others or for themselves. And there's definitely a huge bio effect in both these efforts, which is that you are informing a whole generation at a time when you do something like this.
Yeah, that one really resonates with me. In a previous life, I worked in education, and one of my favorite gigs was designing new high schools in America's largest school district, New York City Department of Education. And we focused on competency-based learning and you know, empowering young people to stand up and say, hey, I think I've mastered this skill. And then they could show their teacher and, you know, tick that off the competency list and move on and things like that. So I had firsthand experience with like going against the grain of the system and seeing how difficult it was to make a system that's so drill and kill, test based, move to this way of thinking about young people as not pails you need to fill, but actually, you know, they have something to bring. And
no, completely. I also remember I grew up in India, and every year we had the Teachers' Day, right? And on Teachers' Day, that was a super fun and exciting experience because you had to pretend that you were a teacher, one of your class teachers, just for that one day. You had to bring in your textbooks, you had to command the classroom, and you had to deliver a lesson. So that experience of actually putting a pupil in a teacher's position, that kind of complete reversal of, I guess, what is a very traditional, conventional dynamic, was so interesting and such a great experience. I often look back at it and I think about the time where you're like, I actually know what it's like to be a teacher now, and it's not easy. So I'm going to be a very different person from this point onwards, you know. So there's something really interesting that we don't always give children credit for in their ability to learn.
Wanted to ask a slightly even broader question. We'd be remiss not to ask about growth strategy and marketing being a growth strategy agency. So would be curious to hear about BFB Labs. What's your growth journey been like to date? How are you positioning yourself for future growth, and kind of what resources are you marshaling for marketing and advertising to spread the good word about what you're doing?
Yeah, there's quite a lot there, Paul. So I'm gonna break that question down. I guess our growth strategy has been very mission-led. We have a clear theory of change, which means that we have a set of goals, which is around providing democratic access to as many young people as possible in a way that is also sustainable, right? We didn't set ourselves up to make an exit, to kind of play the whole game of raising VC funding and make an exit and call it a day. You know, that is not what we see as success. What we see as success is the impact that we are able to make happen. So the more young people we are able to reach and provide benefit to, the more excited we get about the work we are doing. What we've done so far has been obviously extremely innovative, like realizing standard face-to-face therapeutic approaches into digital gaming environments that kind of provide clinical-grade therapy through a gaming vehicle. So I think there's something quite interesting there about how we've done it, and of course why we are doing it. Our drivers are unlike, I guess, some of the big health tech innovators that have gone through their seed round and Series A and B, C, D. We've never taken VC investment. We are running at £1 million ARR as annual recurring revenue at the moment, so in a very strong, steady position as of today, and also developing new interventions. So I guess the idea is to grow in terms of what we offer and who we offer it to, right? So whether that's tackling health inequalities in the UK by reaching young people from ethnic minorities who may not have access otherwise because of cultural implications or stigma, and then also reaching young people who may not get access because they might be neurodivergent and they don't want to be singled out. So acting using our intervention as an equalizer, because you can use it along with a neurotypical peer. So looking at that, or looking overseas, you know, where we look at the world and we're like, so many kids need support today. How do we make this happen? So I think there are a few areas of focus there in terms of geographical reach and what we provide and who we provide it to. That's very much our kind of like vision, that the more we can do around that in terms of like putting an intervention into more hands, the better. I don't know if you're expecting a more sort of like commercially orientated answer, that we want to close Series C and then make an exit and blah, blah, blah. That's not really the way we think. I think we're a little bit of an outlier there.
All right, thank you.
To round off the discussion now, Manjul, I'd love to just ask you a couple of quick fire questions. Starting with, if you could found another tech startup, what would it be and why?
Sure. So obviously, I'm not going to give away what my next tech startup is going to be, but what I can tell you is I strongly feel like women, retired individuals, and migrants, especially, are hugely undervalued. My next tech startup would tap into these incredible human resources and create value for the tech and the business community, because I don't think people see it yet.
That's really cool. Looking forward to seeing what you come up with there. What tech invention makes you the most excited?
I think the kind of coming together of XR, or we can call it extended reality, blended realities with remote communication, gets me really excited, right? I remember getting a phone call from my family 3 days after I had migrated to a completely different continent as a teenager. And I had a basic Motorola. And I remember the extent to which that made me cry. I think I went on for about 5 hours. That was just a phone call. Imagine what remote XR communication could do if we could achieve that at scale, right? And we all have mobile devices. They have 92% penetration in the Western world. So that could be such a game changer for business, for families, for relationships, for trade. It could be really, really powerful. So whoever's working in that space, I'm a little jealous.
And what tech innovation or use case of a tech innovation makes you the most concerned right now?
This is an interesting one, and I thought a little bit about it. I'm less concerned about, I guess, big tech and AI, which is, a hot topic of discussion at the moment. I was at the Web Summit in Lisbon last week, and definitely this was something that was widely being talked about. I think I'm more concerned about the handful of people controlling these. It's so interesting that we elect our government and our representatives, our members of parliament, our prime minister, and so on and so forth. But in the case of technology, which is infiltrating every aspect of our lives, there's no voting, there's no democratic election of who your technology leaders are. So I almost feel like, why aren't we doing that with tech, given its prevalence in our lives, right? So it's less about the technology being used, but about how we are providing that sense of power, the control to specific people. Do we trust them? Do we have faith in them? Do we agree with their values? I don't know, when will this become a bit more of a democratic process?
I'd love to hear about a literal human who's been integral to your career journey, someone you want to call out.
Yeah, this is an easy one. I would say my mom. She's 72 and a real trailblazer, a philanthropist, an optimist. She's great company, and I love putting her on the spot and asking her all sorts of questions. So I asked her the other day, what's AI? She gave me the perfect answer without any reference to anything. I asked her about biofeedback. I asked her about what job I do. I asked her about our games, and she really knows it. I feel like for a 72-year-old to be that switched on and that engaged with technology, which we often kind of, there's a huge bias in our space, whether it's to do with age or location and so on and so forth. I feel like she's a real sort of trailblazer in that sense. Really involved, really engaged. I have a lot of time and respect for her.
Shout out to Manja's mom for those of us who have to explain our job over and over again to our parents as
I'll
many of us
share a
do.
link to the podcast with her afterwards so she
Nice.
can put it on the family WhatsApp group.
Of course, nice.
I imagine this one might come from her as well, then, but what's an inspirational quote that stuck with you throughout your journey in tech?
Yeah, I think something that took root in my childhood. I was massively into sport and extracurricular activities, not really paying a lot of attention to my academic performance at the time. I was a school captain in my first year of A levels, which back home happens to be a 12-year process. So you start in grade one, you finish in grade 12. And one of my teachers basically said to me, in the history of the school, you're going to be the first school captain who's going to fail her final exams. This landed in a classroom environment 3 months before my exams, and really stayed with me. And I ended up topping my class. So I realized something about myself then, that when people say that you're not going to be able to make it, BFP Labs is not going to be able to sell to the NHS, or you won't be able to provide democratic access to children and young people and be sustainable at the same time. I feel like that made me want to work extra hard to make sure that I was able to make that happen, because there's always an answer, is whether we can find it or not, right?
I think that's a great place to end. Yeah, certainly is always an answer. That's sort of the reason we've named our podcast Tech Can't Save Us, because we actually believe that folks like yourself are out there, fixing things and making the world a better place. So we just got to kind of dig and find that answer. So really appreciate your coming on to talk with us, Angel. And where can our listeners learn more about BFP Labs and Luminova and all the good stuff you're doing?
So you can find us on our website. That's bfb-labs.com. You can also find us on socials, @BFB_labs. Feel free to say hi.
Amazing. We'll include that in the episode description. And to all of our audience, please, as always, leave us a review. Give us a 5-star rating if you enjoyed the episode today. It helps us get great guests like Manjul onto the pod. And Manjul, thank you again for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Thanks, Maya. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.